I'm prepared to do anything I can
well,
to
play
the country again.
Do it then. What about your start to the game?
It wasn't bad, was it?
Why should it be an honest answer be a mistake?
How can a modern day manager not have a mobile phone?
Why should he?
Ah, oui. Allez, Thierry. Allez.
Oui.
Henry, still Henry, the opposition just melted away from him. Oh, we need an extra supply of superlatives for this fella.
I have my way, Alan Shearer at his way, Ian Wright at his way, Suarez at his way. Now, you know, we're all kind of different, but that was my way. I couldn't stay in the middle and wait for crosses.
Now, here's a situation that Thierry Henry could exploit against Chris Berry. It's the classic one against one, and Henry's beaten him, and Henry has scored! Oh, yes! 2-0!
Running at Harman and away from him. And running at Carragher and away from him. Still, Thierry Henry! Fantastic goal! Absolutely brilliant from Henry!
He won the fans to the point where they could turn around to any other football club in the country and say, well, we've got a player as good as you. You know, you can talk of Rooney, you can talk of Ronaldo, but we've got Thierry Henry.
Henry! What a goal!
Have a look at one of the greatest goals I've seen on this ground. That's deliberate. That's majestic. Sheer brilliance. Sheer brilliance. That's all you can say about that piece of football.
I cried when I left. It was pretty hard.
I did. It wasn't an easy thing to do.
Here is Henry. Can he bounce back for Barca? Oh, yes, he can!
Couffon, ça plonge bien!
But there's the handball by Henry.
And by the way, not just once, George, but twice. It's actually hit him on the arm and then he's controlled it with his hand.
Oh, that's a handball, no question about it. Absolutely no question about it. And France have stolen the lead on aggregate.
Henry, chance, goal! He may be cast in bronze, but he's still capable of producing truly golden moments.
Oh yeah,
who can forget all nine names?
Oh yeah, who can forget it, eh? Scored some good goals in his day.
He wasn't bad.
The United one, the little flick up, back to goal.
Yeah.
Whew, far top corner, past Barthez.
Yeah.
Well, that was the pick of the bunch.
I think so. Remember the one he scored against Tottenham as well in the North London Derby where he's run the length of the pitch and dragged it onto his left foot and put it in the corner.
Scored a similar one against Liverpool, didn't he?
Did he have something like that as well? Yeah. I remember the one he scored at Ewood Park once as well, where he's in the inside left channel corner of the 18-yard box and he just bends one. I think it was a brilliant breakaway. I think Fabregas actually just played him in down the inside left channel and he's just opened his body out. Like, we know the goal, we've seen it, and he just bends it into the top corner. I remember that one sticks in my mind a little bit as well.
Likes to talk a lot. I didn't realise how much he liked to talk until I started watching the show with himself, Roy Keane and Kenny Dalglish.
Yeah. Woo! What did you think of that? Hard work.
It was hard. There were moments. The moments were all around Roy's face and wondering what Roy was thinking when Henri was talking, because Roy was on his very, very best behaviour.
Yeah.
When Roy is with elite players, I think he feels like he's in the sort of company he wants to be in, and he should show Kenny Dalglish and Thierry Henry respect because it puts him at their level, and when people are talking about the greatest players of the Premier League era, he wants to be part of their conversation and he wants to be invited to the best parties.
He doesn't need to feel part of it because he is part of it. That's a simple fact.
He is, but he won't be invited back again if he's going to be having a go at Thierry Henry.
Okay. All right.
There was the highlight of when they were talking, when Thierry was talking about Ruud van Nistelrooy missing the penalty and Martin Keown jumping all over him. Did a bit of a ding-dong there. There was Thierry talking about how great the United 99 team were, where he spoke for, I'd say, 4 minutes solid, saying, they're good.
Yeah.
Many, many times, and Roy just looking at him going,
"Yeah,
I really don't understand what you're on about.
Quite a lot of that, I found myself just switching off from it. I remember one instance he was talking about getting onto the pitch and seeing the grass and how the grass is in the distance and how much it means to you going onto the pitch and stepping over the line. And he said the same thing. I was just like, nah, just wasn't really my cup of tea, actually, no.
His best goal was his fourth against Leeds when Gary Kelly tripped him and he still scored. I feel I'm going to go into a deep dive of YouTube as the
yeah,
night goes on.
There'll be enough. There'll be enough. What did you say scored earlier on? Was it
176? I think it was.
Was it? Yes. It's enough to choose from, isn't there?
Yeah.
There'll be a lot that you won't remember.
Well, he is celebrating. Listen, we didn't go as overboard as we did for your 40th birthday. That was a truly magical occasion in Irish sport. But we thought we would talk a little bit about Thierry Henry, and I'm delighted to say we've one of Thierry's teammates on the line, Ray Parler. Evening, Ray.
How you doing, guys? You okay?
It sounds like you're out watching a bit of football.
I'm in the garden at the moment. Yeah. So, just
the next generation of parlors.
Yeah, there's a few kids running around and whatever. So, hopefully, who knows?
So, we wanted to talk to you about Thierry Henry. You might think back to when he first arrived at Arsenal. So he'd had an underwhelming season at Juventus. He was part of the France squad that won the World Cup in '98, and I guess underwhelming maybe is the word to use for even the way he arrived at the club, because it certainly seemed from a goal-scoring point of view that he didn't hit the ground running. Were there any suggestions in those opening months that he would go on to become the player he did?
Well, obviously, he was a massive signing. We just lost Nicolas Anelka, which was a bit of a blow, because I thought he would have had a great career at Arsenal as well. But with the money from that sale, they bought a new training ground, and obviously Thierry Henry. And he didn't really hit the ground running like we thought he would, because obviously he was playing wide areas for Juventus, but obviously worked with Arsene Wenger for many years at Monaco. So I think Arsene Wenger knew that he could fit into the team very easily. But again, as you rightly said there, he didn't really hit the ground running. He probably didn't score in his first six or seven games. So, you know, he just needed that little bit of a chance and a goal to get his confidence high. And he certainly done that when he scored at Southampton at the Old Dell, his first ever goal. And after that, he was absolutely different class.
Mm. It was just the one goal before December. He ended up finishing that first season with 17 league goals. Understandable in many ways that it would be a slow start. He's a young guy. He's 22. He's coming into a whole different culture and a whole different group of players and a style of play. And we've heard stories of Martin Keown giving him a warm welcome at training, but the type of welcome that really stood to him through the years.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it did help him that there was a lot of French guys there anyway. You know, I mean, we had Patrick Vieira, Remy Gard, Jules Grimondi and people like that at the club. So that helped him settle a little bit quicker. But certainly, you know, the training and he wasn't used to the physicality of probably the Premier League. But you knew that he had signs that he could be a top-class striker, even early in his career. So, you know, he didn't really let anyone down in that department, because he ended up, because of his frame, and, you know, he wasn't the smallest, 6'2". He had the build of an athlete as well. And, you know, certainly once he got in his stride and started running, he was unbelievable. Very hard to catch. And that was always going to be great for him to have that sort of attributes in his game. But his finishing itself, I didn't think I could see another striker like in Ian Wright or beat his record, Ian Wright's record. But certainly Thierry didn't have anybody down in that department, and ended up beating him by 50 goals, which is amazing, really.
Martin Keown said, "I trained like I played, and my philosophy was that new players were going to find out how tough it was in England, so they might as well find out from us first." I'm sure he took that attitude to pretty much every new signing that came into the club. I'm sure Nicolas Anelka probably found the same thing when he joined Arsenal as well. Was there something about Henry's character that you could tell by the way he responded to that challenge that he was going to go on and be a success?
Well, again, it's very important that we have people like Martin, you know, who could really, you know, make tackles. And he, more or less, Martin said to him, "Look, you're going to get this every single week in the Premier League." So I think he really did deal with that very well. But Thierry was, you know, he could look after himself. I think he was a winner, which is so important to have. And, you know, he was a winning mentality. And we had that already in the team and in the squad itself. With obviously the famous back four and David Seaman and people like that. But obviously Thierry just fitted in straight away. And again, he was electric, absolutely different class in training as well. I think he was one of them sort of players that had to train hard to play the way he did every single week. Certain players didn't have to do that. And I think Thierry was one of them, always trying to improve. And, you know, he ended up becoming a master at his game and obviously scoring all them goals.
It was interesting as well seeing Thierry Henry alongside Roy Keane and Kenny Dalglish during the debates this week, and he spoke specifically about Martin Keown, that day-to-day, Martin Keown brought the best out in him that was obviously beneficial for him when he got on the pitch. But the one thing that Lee Dixon was saying as well, Lee Dixon saying in relation to what something you've touched on before, when Nicholas Anelka left the club, you wanted a striker coming in, yet you felt when he'd come in, you'd signed a winger that you'd reverted to a striker, and he didn't seem to know the position too well. It's not so much he'd forgotten the role, but he hadn't been playing there for such a long time. So you mentioned before about how he maybe just took a bit of time before he adjusted and before he got up to speed, but was that noticeable in training when you're on the training ground alongside him, that he didn't actually know the position as well as maybe when you had Nicholas Anelka that immediately knew one of you midfielders would have picked up the ball, immediately looking to spin in behind, whereas Henry might have been coming short, might not necessarily been doing the same sort of runs or making the same sort of runs, should I say?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that's what training's all about. To get, obviously, Arsene Wenger knew what his days at Monaco, that he could do the job. But sometimes it's difficult when you start playing a little bit wider and then you revert back to a centre forward. But certainly he was the man, he knew he had the ability and the wisdom to do that. And he certainly did that. And, you know, when you've got people like Dennis Bergkamp behind you as well, that makes it a little bit easier for you, because he knew when Dennis picked the ball up, he'd make his run into certain areas and you're going to get it delivered as well with players of that calibre. So, you know, I think Thierry, once he got used to playing the way as players and as a manager, what we want him to do, then he knew exactly every single week what to do. But his finishing as well, once he got into areas, you know, you knew exactly where the ball would end up in the back of the net. And that's why he was such a prolific goal scorer and a fantastic guy as well.
I mean, I've seen you in your book as well, Ray. You talked about his goal scoring record. We could go on about all these sort of things as well. But having played against him as well and recognising that it wasn't necessarily, you know, he was that sort of player you get tight with, and he could destroy you with his skill. You give him a little bit, you stand off him, and he'll just destroy you with his pace.
Yeah.
Nathan and I were just talking before we came in before. He was actually quite decent in the air, but he also had the clever movement as well of a striker that could goal poach. He could spin off the shoulder defenders in tight areas. He didn't necessarily need a bundle of spacing behind him. He was the complete striker in every sense of the word, wasn't he?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the way he just opened his body out when he got into areas, and just passed it into the net a lot of the time. So, you know, he was a very clever player. He drifted out to the left-hand side quite often. That was probably where he'd been playing for Juventus at times, but he was really hard to pick up. You know, he was always thinking, if the man's tight to me, I'll spin behind. If there's a little bit of space, I can run at players. And, you know, that's why he was so special as a player. And again, once he got that bit of confidence and belief that he could do it week in, week out, and that's what he did. And he got better and better as a player. And he was a great lad as well, because sometimes you need great lads in that dressing room area. And probably Arsene Wenger on a Friday, he had 16 players who were really going to never wanted to lose. And Thierry was part of that. And he was the one who really we relied on. He could change a game probably on his own. He's that sort of player. Where Dennis Bergkamp was very clever and got some great positions and delivered the passing. But Thierry, I think the game always sticked out for me, was 2004, the unbeaten season, was when we was right up against, we lost to Chelsea in the Champions League, and then we had Liverpool, a Highbury, and he scored a hat-trick that day. And, you know, it was unbelievable. How he played in that game was amazing. And to be part of that team myself was a real honour, to play with the likes of Thierry and Dennis Bergkamp and people like that.
Did he change the way we look at that real elite level of striker? I'm thinking of the way it's gone now with Messi and Ronaldo, that once upon a time a striker, all they really had to do was score goals, whereas he scored the goals. And Kevin touched on the record. There was a five-season spell where he scored over 24 league goals every single one of those seasons, won the Golden Boot four times. But he was everywhere. He would drift out to the left-hand side, as you touched on there. He would drop deep. He'd get himself involved in the game. He'd probably have far more touches of the ball than we would have expected of, maybe I'm going back a bit too
Anelka,
far, but
Anelka,
or even going further back to Lineker, Rush, the sort of poachers, the guys we would have expected to get 30 goals a season.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, Ian Wright was probably one of them sort of players as well, you know, a poacher in front of goal. But probably how we played, very similar to, with one up front, you've got to have movement, you've got to have, you know, he's going to be pinnacle to if you're going to win games as centre forward. And if you look at how we played, because them days you probably played more like a two up front and you fed off each other, but Dennis would drift into that number 10 role. So he was probably an out-and-out striker himself in them days. And, you know, he learnt that job and knew exactly what he had to do. As soon as certain players got the ball, he was off. You know, he made that run Perez and people like that would find you. And I think he learned it so well that it was just natural to him in the end. You know, he would know certain players exactly where he's got to be and get in between players, which was a real art as well, and make himself really difficult to mark. And as a centre-half, that's the worst probably. Mobility of a centre-forward is the worst probably sign you can have. And that you don't want someone just sitting there on you and keep making runs in behind, because that's very, very difficult to pick up.
How quickly did he immerse himself into the dressing room? I spoke there about Martin maybe giving him a kick or two in training, and yeah, yourself maybe the one of the more experienced players maybe in that dressing room at the time as well. But there was a lot of characters in that dressing room, a lot of real men, I suppose you would say, that Arsenal side had. So how quickly did he become engrossed in that culture at the club and really take to Arsenal? Was that a difficult adjustment for him?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, again, I'll go back to the French lads who were already there. They helped him a lot. But he sat next to me in training a lot in the dressing room areas. He was number 14, I was number 15. But he was a real good lad. He couldn't believe, you know, the so much difference of playing in Italy and France, because we was all mates, really, you know. And he loved all the banter. Obviously, I tried to teach him a bit of Cockney slang and mucking about.
How'd that go?
He was brilliant. He said it live on TV once as well. He had a shot and he came off the post. And I said, right, Thierry, this is your big chance. All you got to say is I had a bit of luck off the beans on toast. And he told me to say it because I was doing the interview as well. But, you know, he was that sort of guy. He just wanted a bit of fun as well. And he couldn't believe that, you know, the British guys, you know, after training, would all sit upstairs and have lunch and have chats about just normal things in life. And, you know, he didn't see that in Italy or France, and he really did enjoy that, as a lot of the foreign players did. So I think we was a big part of that, the British guys, and to make them welcome and, you know, get them into that dressing room area. And that's probably where you win a dressing room, where you win games sometimes, from the dressing room. And certainly he really played into that part, and he was a great lad to have around.
You're one of the players who straddled, I guess, the two generations of Arsenal players who really led the way for the first generation when you had the Tuesday Club and you had the Sunday Sessions.
That wasn't Ray. Ray wasn't into that sort of thing. No, that wasn't his game.
So I was chairman of that, I think.
you had that side of it, and then you moved on to when Arsene Wenger came in and the French Legion came in as well, and you sort of set the standards in terms of looking at football in a different way, in the way that you looked after your bodies, and it was far more sensible. Was there another side to Henri? You sort of touched upon it there, that you still hung out and had lunch together and all that. But was there another side to that group as well, that you would go out the odd time, that you would still have those odd Tuesday clubs?
Well, yeah. I mean, it did change. Football's changing all the time. It's even changed more now. You know, with all the social media, you've got to be very careful what you do. But yeah, I probably had two generations of that. Look, no one, when you look back in your career, that was great fun. I mean, the early 90s, it's brilliant, you know, the Tuesday clubs and mixing out. But you just can't do that now. You go with the times, really. And obviously, Arsene Wenger came in 96. And things were changing in not just Arsenal, but in football in general. So you have to be more professional. And certainly, we still had the odd night out. We still went out, obviously, Christmas parties and things like that. And the foreign guys loved it. They really did. You know, we wouldn't go as mad as we used to when we was going out for a drink, but we certainly had a few glasses of wine and a few beers, and you know, because sometimes you have to have that release. You have to have that, you know, in football. People look at it now, and so much pressure on guys to play well every week. Sometimes you have a rough spell, but them sort of nights out or lunches out, that sometimes that can really spark the dressing room again and get you going. So Thierry was part of that, as all the lads were, and he certainly played his part in when we was having a bad time to get back into winning ways, which, lucky enough, we had players to do that.
I've seen him described as the most important player in Arsenal's history. It was Gilberto Silva was one of those who was saying it, having played with him. And I just think when you look at Arsenal's timeline and the decision to move to the Emirates and, say, the fees that they're looking at for season tickets and the corporate side of it, that a big part of that was having a figurehead like Thierry Henry, who had this sexy football, that played this stunning style of football, that Arsenal wouldn't have been able to sell the Emirates and sell all that side of it if they didn't have Thierry Henry.
No, definitely not. He was a big part of that. You know, when he first turned up, no one really knew he was going to be beating Ian Wright's record by 50 goals, which is an amazing achievement. But yeah, I mean, we had top-class players all around the park. I mean, Perez was a great player. We had Bergkamp. But Thierry was, you know, everybody looked at Thierry as the main man. You know, scores your goals, does a lot more than just score goals as well. He created lots of chances for other players, where he made his runs, and obviously that was the big turning point for Arsenal Football Club, 2006, moving to the new stadium. And, you know, I think that definitely he would have sold a lot more tickets that Thierry was playing for Arsenal Football Club, or that he wouldn't have done if he was playing for, say, Barcelona or someone. So, yeah, I definitely agree with that. And he was a big part of that club. And probably, if you go down to most of the guys who played with the likes of Dennis and Thierry, they'd probably be number one and two in the history of Arsenal Football Club, the best players.
Did he ever suggest over all those years that he might have a problem with Irish people and that eventually he might try and screw us over? Was there any incident that happened? Kevin Kilbane kick him as he was going past him?
Well, I've always given him a couple of pints of Guinness and he really liked that. So I'm sure he does like the Irish guys, and it's just, yeah. I mean, I couldn't believe it as well when it happened, and I felt for the Irish guys, and you just got to make sure when you're playing a charity match next, Kev, you just got to give him a little bit of a dig.
I've tried to, but you got to catch him. That's the problem, isn't it? He'd probably still run 100 metres in 11 seconds.
He's actually got slow by now, I'm sure, so you'll be all right.
Ray, brilliant to talk to you. Thanks a lot for taking the call.
Cheers, guys.
Thanks, Ray. Thank you.
Hello.
Charity match with Thierry Henry. I'd be staying over the other side of the pitch, I think.
Yeah.
He's still in decent shape.
I'd say, yeah, you wouldn't play right back, would you? Right side, centre-half?
I wouldn't be playing in any charity match. No chance. I'd definitely be playing right back.
Yeah.
Not a wing back.
I'm trying to think about right back. Where do you play in our Wednesday morning sessions? You know, I hear all the talk from you and Dave and
a
all these sort of things.
Controlling midfielder.
Yeah. Giving a bit of stick out and commentary when you're on air and things like this. And then I've actually seen you playing. So, yeah. 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 We'll leave it at that.
The listeners most definitely do not want to hear about our footballing careers, or my footballing career, whatever about yours. We have made a terrible error, though. Once again, we're giving Thierry Henry all the credit and we're leaving out the real villain. It's somebody else's birthday today. Also celebrating their 40th birthday today, William Gallas.
Is it really?
Born on the same day as Thierry Henry.
That is a joke.
It's not. It's 100% true.
Oh.
Wow, Tom Clancy on Twitter. 40 years since the score of the most infamous goal in Irish football was born. Happy birthday, William Gallas. William Gallas gets away with one, doesn't he? I'm always on the verge of saying that Henry scored the goal.
Yeah, but you can't blame Gallas. I tell you, the one thing that, and I'll say it, go on about it again, I have said it before, is the reaction. It was Henry's reaction after the goal went in. And he was like, you know, he ran up behind the goal and back across. And I was like, come on. When you watch it back, it looks terrible. It looks awful. You know, something you're a bit cowardly, like,
Bababoom.
Oh, what have I done there, you know, on a pitch? But nah.
Text on Henry's best goal. Guys, it has to be the goal against Charlton where he is back to goal, backheel the ball through the defender's leg into the bottom corner.
Yeah, I think it was Dean Kiley's goal for that, wasn't it?
Oh, it was the awareness.
Yeah.
Do you play against them often?
Yeah, loads.
Did you play in the game? You didn't play in the last game at Highbury for Wigan?
Oh, no. I played in... No, I didn't. I wasn't at Wigan at the time. But I did play at Highbury, which was the season we qualified for the Champions League, when we qualified on the Sunday.
Oh, yeah.
And Henry came off the bench that night, and I tried to absolutely smash him. And I missed him in the tackle.
Did you lose 6-1?
He hurdled me. Bit more than that, actually.
7-1.
Yeah, we'll leave that.
I'm sure there's a full 90 minutes of it somewhere.
Yeah, we'd had a few drinks in that leading up to that game. But Henry looked at me like I was a piece of... Oh, and he just looked at me.
Were you stinking a drink?
No, I wouldn't say that. No, that,
but
that
was a definite wave.
That would be totally unprofessional, Nathan, as you know. Yeah.
Wow. Well, it's good that you celebrated then, because you didn't really get to enjoy too much of the old Champions League football in the end, did you?
Oh, right. Cheers. Thanks for that. Yeah.
I didn't want to bring
honestly,
it up.
Great knowledge of football you've got. Honest to God.
I'm just putting it out there. I have been looking at some of his goals. The fourth where we mentioned where Gary Kelly trips him is just unbelievable.
Is it? Yeah. I don't remember it.
Oh, again, you're looking at it going, Pires with the touch. It's just sensational. Little touch just inside the Leeds half. Dribbles into the area. Just as he's about to clip it in, Gary Kelly has a little nibble at his heel.
Yeah.
Somehow manages to stay on his feet and dinks it past the keeper.
Yeah, do you remember the free kick as well that he took when the ref was making him making the wall go 10 yards?
Oh, yeah.
And he waited for the referee. So did he take the free kick, miss, or whatever it would be? And the referee's called him back to do it. I can't remember what happened anyway. Anyway, he scored.
That was against Wigan as well, wasn't it?
Was it against Wigan?
Yeah.
I wasn't playing at Wigan at the time. And then he scored anyway, the free kick. So looked to the referee, is that okay? Is that right? And it was just like, you just want to give him a slap, don't you?
Yeah, he was effortlessly cool. It's a shame he did that cool thing and it's ruined it for
was
us.
Was he cool?
I don't know. I think he was at the time.
Someone who...
Slick.
Slick, yeah. Sometimes you see people that actually try to be cool and that's just oof, isn't cool.
Oof. Oof. It's his birthday. It'd be nice.
Yeah. No, not. I'm not saying about Thierry Henry, but I'm saying in general that could be the way.
Ireland have scored what is a consolation try right at the end against France, but they trail by 21 points to 5. We'll check in with Oisin, and we'll also go to Barcelona on what has been a very difficult day there, and we'll talk to Graeme Hunter.
Off the ball on News Talk, thanks to Air. Manchester United, Arsenal and Manchester City are all in live Premier League action this month on the Air Sport Pack.
So unfortunately, Ireland have missed out on a place in the semi-finals of the Women's Rugby World Cup, beaten by France 21 points to 5. We will check in with Oisin Langan at UCD before the end of the show. But it's been a horrific day in Barcelona. Anybody who's ever been to Barcelona will have been on Las Ramblas, I'm sure. It is the main tourist area. A terrorist attack. Latest information we have is that 12 people were killed when a car drove straight through tourists and anybody who was on Las Ramblas in the afternoon today. As always on a Thursday, we talk with Graeme Hunter. Graeme, doesn't feel right to play your intro music or anything like that on difficult day for your home city.
I'm glad you didn't, Nathan. I think there's a path to be drawn. We can't, any of us, allow ourselves to be diverted from maybe doing the ordinary things that we would do. It's our livelihood to talk about football. But maybe we do so with more care and respect for our profession and respect for life today. I would only say that I've lived in Barcelona. You know, I was on that exact spot earlier today, not close to when it happened, but, you know, a couple of hours difference. And I think what, you know, having lived in this city for nearly as long as I've lived in any city, I feel like it's mine. And the sensation is that when these things happen, You pay respect, you hope that the authorities catch the perpetrators, and then you determinedly show that you're moving on, and we all determinedly show that they'll never defeat us or divert us or impact us. And maybe that's where we stand tonight.
Well said, and I know you want to move on, and we will, and we've just been talking about a former Barcelona great, actually. We've just been talking about Thierry Henry, because a man who lit up that city for so long. His 40th birthday today, we were talking to Ray Parler about how good he was at Arsenal and how much of a Premier League legend he is. We shouldn't forget about what he did at Barcelona as part of one of the greatest attacks of all time, one of the greatest teams of all time, alongside Lionel Messi and Samuel Eto'o. And I think actually one of his best bits of punditry on Sky Sports was when he was explaining what Pep Guardiola wanted that attacking trio to do. Your memories of Henry and the impact he made?
I'm glad you asked me. When I wrote the book about Barcelona, I deliberately went back and tried to fill in the gaps of memory. Because I think that however closely you chronicle or pay attention, the mind is a strange thing, memory is a strange thing. So I went back and looked very hard. And if you remember in that first season when Pep takes over, there's something they called Tourmalet, which I think is one of the mountain climbs in the Tour de France. And they use that phrase to describe anything that looks, in sporting terms, insurmountable. And Barcelona and Madrid were faced with a weird anomaly of the fixtures whereby each of them, obviously in a different order, played in sequence each other, Valencia, Villarreal, Atletico Madrid and Sevilla. So literally Barcelona faced something like Atletico Madrid, Sevilla, Real Madrid, Valencia and Villarreal in a sequence of matches. And particularly in the midwinter, when the Guardiola effect was still, you know, taking root, when Madrid were champions and Barcelona had been pretty humiliated the season before, Thierry Henry's role in those games was extremely important in terms of goals made, assists made, level of performance. He stood up. And that book that I wrote, you both know, Duncan McMath and I have turned it into a sort of feature film documentary we've finished. We've been proud to be able to say that, you know, every single senior member of that treble team took part, including Messi and Pep Guardiola, took part in the film. These things are rarities. But so did Thierry Henry. And in fact, Thierry Henry was eager to do so. And you asked me, what do I remember? You talked about him lighting things up. Well, remember, he came in a season when things went awfully wrong. He waited a year after the defeat in Paris of Arsenal, was furious, then joined, and he was part of that final year of Frank Rijkaard. He was part of the guard of honour that Barcelona had to make at the Bernabeu for already crowned champions Real Madrid, who then went out and beat Barcelona 4-1 with Xavi sent off. And Thierry Henry in our film says, everybody wanted me out. I was part of what people wanted to change. The crowd were against us. Things weren't right. So if you look at his achievements in the treble season at Fold, if you look at the work that, Pep Guardiola did, not only in persuading him to stay, but telling the board that he wouldn't sell Thierry Henry, but sticking by him and educating him clearly about what his role was, it was a really big transformation, because he wasn't the superhero that he'd become at Arsenal, all-time, maybe Arsenal's leading player ever, certainly their leading scorer. He wasn't the all-time hero that he was with France, two international trophies. Therefore, it's a really interesting sector of his life, and you nailed it, Nathan. He did eventually play an extremely big role in the treble, and I remember him telling me that when it sort of finalises in Rome, beating Manchester United to clinch the Champions League in the treble, Thierry Henry to this day has still no idea how he played. The famous thing is that Iniesta was at best 60% fit, and his thigh muscle was threatening to snap at any moment. Thierry Henry was no much better than that, and therefore I go again. Just an interesting, checkered, up and down, but ultimately glorious part of Thierry Henry's career.
We haven't prepped you for this, and I'm putting you on the spot, but when we are talking about Barcelona front threes over the last 10 years, and so you have Messi, Henry, Eto'o, you have Pedro, Villa, Messi, you have the current, are they just gone, Neymar, Suarez, Messi, which of those is your favourite?
It's very, very, very hard
choosing
to call
a child.
I'll have to say that when Eto'o went, it was obvious to me he'd gone too soon. The ferocity of his play, the way in which he helped transform Barcelona from being timid to being nothing stands in our way, bold. I thought I couldn't have Eto'o overcome in my respect for a striker, but David Villa made me do that. So although it isn't the most famous of the trios, although David Villa and Messi, in football terms, didn't see eye to eye, because Villa was put out wide, Messi was the boss, wanted the ball when he wanted the ball, and there were sparks. The formation when Messi and Villa are in the same team, that Villa is in my view, the best centre-forward I've ever seen. The most complete. Different from many nines, didn't wear nine a lot on his back, was willing to play out wide, but David Villa is still, to this day, I think, in Britain and Ireland, underestimated in terms of competitive spirit, ability, leadership, crucial goal-scoring ability. Just absolutely phenomenal.
I'd certainly go along with that. I would.
You'd underrated. Have him ahead of Suarez?
No, I wouldn't say that, but I'd go along with the fact he's underrated and how underrated he is. Yeah, Suarez would certainly be in my mind, and that's only what's happened in the last couple of years. Graham, given what's happened today, and the league's of course starting this Friday now, the league is starting Friday, Barcelona starts Sunday against Real Betis. How important now is it for the city of Barcelona now to maybe have a celebration this weekend and try to come together as a city, as one? Espanyol are away at Sevilla this weekend as well, but particularly for Barcelona, how important now is it for this weekend ahead of that game?
I think before we reach the Camp Nou on Sunday night, one of the things that I can identify about this city is that for the length of time me and my family and I have been here, it has reminded me of a Britain I grew up in. It isn't quite yet like modern Britain. People still protest. People still support each other. People still manifest. Things like when the Gulf War was taking place, Spain agreed to be part of the general consensus, and the population, or certain parts of the population, were very vehemently against it. There were protests on the street every night. People were, banging pots and pans at their window, banging umbrellas on street lampposts. And I mention that because prior to the Camp Nou, it's my belief, it's my intuition that over the coming days, you'll see, as we've seen in other cities, mass demonstrations of opposition to this bravery, civic pride, morning too. And therefore, by the time we reach the camp now, I accept your point that there'll be those who have died will be remembered, will be respected, will be honoured. But I haven't got a proper, I haven't got a clear answer to your question, because it seems, on a night like this, it seems such a distance away. And I mean very sincerely that we must do our jobs and they must do their jobs and we must not be deterred by, you know, cowards and terrorists like this. But it does to me seem like a month away Sunday night. There'll be a lot to happen in the city, a lot to learn about before then. And I'll venture something. I feel like I'm going out on a limb a little bit here. But I talked at the time when Eric Abidal had twice suffered cancer and Dani Alves offered him part of his liver and wanted to unite with his colleague and say, I don't care about my career if I can help save your life. And that happened twice. And then Tito Villanova was struck by cancer three times and they thought and hoped that he was getting better and he wasn't and he died. You've lived a professional sportsman's life, Kevin. So I'm still only speculating. But when I talked to either those players or their family members, without any of them protesting and coming out and saying to me, we're only human too, you would have needed to be senseless, you know, without any of your brain or your experience as a human being, not to notice that they were deeply affected, that it mattered to them, that some of them were distraught. And because this has happened in their city, because the majority of them have, or many, many of them have lived here all their life or all their adult life, you know, these footballers who've got a sporting crisis going on because the club and the squad are in relatively dire straits, they'll be badly affected. And I won't go there looking for, you know, a champagne performance to give the people a bustle and something to take away so that their daily lives seem less affected. You know, my sympathies will be with those who have to go out and play on Sunday night. I think they should. I think they clearly should. But if it were me, you know, my appetite for it wouldn't be high.
You touched upon there how Barcelona have dealt with tragedy within the club and difficulties within the club. And even at all that has gone on and all that has changed behind the scenes and some of the corporate deals and the commercial deals they've gone through, is there still that strong connection between the people of the city and the people who go to the games and the players on the pitch?
It changes, it evolves. Yes, is the truthful answer. I see, I know neighbours, I know in all the communities I've lived in across Barcelona, there are people whose lives, whose cheer, whose outlook on the world depends on. It's no different from, you know, Blackburn or Sunderland or Leeds or Birmingham or Arsenal or Chelsea or Aberdeen. Whether those who go to the stadium are the same core audience as when I moved here 15, 16 years ago, the answer is no. But if one of your questions is some sort of cord, umbilical cord between Barcelona and what was its traditional support broken, the answer is definitely no. The cost is too much for some people. Undoubtedly, the Catalans are not rabidly loyal. We must go to the stadium because our team's in a time of need. They vote with their feet. They come in tides. During a game, they come in tides, sometimes late, out early at halftime, back in tightness to the second half, and then away before, so they can get, you know, out of the parking situation. That's not my concept of football. It's not what I grew up with. I can't speak for Ireland, but certainly in Britain, we've got a warrior mentality about, like, if your team's in trouble, you're with them. You stay. Your criticism comes afterwards. And Catalan support for Barcelona isn't like that. They're full and they're noisy and they're bouncy when they're on top or when the football is good. But if you remember, if you go back to when Frank Rijkaard's reign was clearly sunk, there were crowds of 56, 66,000 compared to the 80s and 90s. That's a full stadium in Britain missing, you know, of 25, 30,000 people. So over the years I've been here, you know, the ebb and flow of the passion that people feel for Barcelona hasn't changed one iota. But their attendance at the stadium, their willingness to criticise, and their willingness to get behind the team on a match like against Real Betis, where there'll be no Suarez, there'll probably be no Piqué, they've lost Neymar, two-thirds of the team is out of form, and they could get a bloody nose again after losing so heavily to Real Madrid. I don't expect the fans to be like, if we come to the aid of the team, they view it the other way around.
You just mentioned there, sorry, that game though last night, and Real Madrid, no Bale, no Ronaldo, no Isco last night. How good are they, and what can this young Real Madrid side now? What can they achieve, Graham? Just moving on, I suppose, from that. But last night, Nathan and I both watched the game last night, and seeing that Real Madrid side, and seeing how good they're actually becoming, and how they're maturing now. They just look so good under Zidane, and where they're going to.
I'm a flat out admirer of what's happened since Zidane came in. I think it was sort of January 2015, I think. It's one full season and half a season. It's seven trophies. I've literally got nothing to say that I would want to change or improve about it. But I look at last night, and I tell you what, the tom-tom drums from the training ground from that January when Rafa Benitez was removed and Zidane, reluctantly by Florentino Perez, was placed in. He tried to get Mourinho. He was unwilling to trust Zidane. So this is not an act of genius by that president, believe me. But from day one, the players sat up and paid attention. They were like, it wasn't like, well, this is Zizou, this is World Cup winner, this is Real Madrid legend. That gets you a little bit. But he'd been in there, they knew him already, and the training changed, and the attention changed. And the first message I got from training was, it's sharp, it's tight, it's disciplined. Everybody knows it's a meritocracy. So here we come now, and they beat any test. They beat you when you defend. They beat you if they give you a couple of goals lead. They beat you. They beat you when they shouldn't. They beat you sometimes with the referee. When they want to beat you for fun, they'll pummel you and you can ship goals. But I'll tell you something. Although the Catalan football press and the socios here, and Gerard Piqué when he came off injured, he was caught saying something pretty robust, but saying that they're leading us a merry dance. They're running rings around us. It's clear that Barcelona weren't good. It's clear that Madrid were vastly superior. But there's something that confused me, and I'm taking to Avizandum that I want to learn more about, because I've seen Madrid teams absolutely pump Barcelona. That night, I talked about the 4-1. They trashed them that night. Now, Madrid could have conceded four goals at the Bernabeu. Easily. Now, not just the ones that hit the post. There was one-on-one chances. There was fluffs by Barcelona. And this was a very, very poor Barcelona. And 2-0 for 5-1 is a serious win. And we know that they're very good. But they didn't go through the gears. They didn't take Barcelona apart, which I think was there for them. And I think a really ruthless, mean team, like say Manchester United were at one stage, you really turn Barcelona over. You do them in that situation. And they probably don't recover for 3 or 4 months.
Yeah.
So I think there was something big. I think there was a big opportunity missed at the Bernabeu the other night, albeit that Real Madrid are fabulous to watch, and they're packed with talent. That midfield, you mentioned the players you were missing. That midfield just functions. Good players that trust each other, that work hard for each other. There is a clear all-for-one, one-for-all spirit. Mm. And also right across the team, if you look at pure ability, that right now, I don't think there's another. Nowhere in Europe do you say you take 14, 15, maybe 16 players and say, is there any better 16 players than the first 16 at Madrid? And the answer is no. But when you get that working, when you get them all pulling for each other every single day, not in just in big weeks when it's a big game coming up, that's Zidane's major, major achievement. They know it's a meritocracy, and they know that whoever plays, they'll get equal commitment.
All right. Graham, great stuff as always. You've spoken really well this evening. Stay safe over the next few days, and we'll talk football more next Thursday. Good luck.
Thanks, Graham.
Thanks, Nathan. Thanks.
Off the Ball on News Talk. Thanks to Air. Catch all the sports you love free on the Air Sport Pack with Air Broadband.